Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, jumping in to tell you about this week's episode of Meat and Three, Heritage Radio Network's weekly food roundup. This week, we're introducing you to some amazing women taking a stand.
So often, being sexually harassed feels like a loss of control. And so I wanted to have these very tangible guides to say, here's what you can do.
Others are pushing for more diversity at major food industry events.
I still feel really determined to do, you know, whatever I can to help shift that and in a direction that's not just more diverse, but more equitable.
We also have a report on that summer business staple, the lemonade stand.
The lemonade stand might be the purest form of starting a business. Low overhead, easy to get into, and requires little experience or special equipment.
Don't miss Meat and Three, your weekly 15-minute food news roundup from HRN. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. Search MEAT plus sign THREE. And thanks, as always, for listening.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
In thinking about what OTM was, it was what I wanted. What I wanted within a restaurant. What I wanted as far as, you know, my life growing up, my first job that I had in a restaurant was incredibly influential. It's why I'm cooking still today, is because of, you know, the influence that they had on me. And that was a mom and pop place and the kids were running around.
That's Chef Tim Hollingsworth of OTM Restaurant in Los Angeles, California, talking about his life and career.
If you go to OTM on the right day, you know, my little kids are running around.
Is that right?
And my wife is there. Yeah. I mean, and all the employees, they know, you know, like I can literally drop my daughter off there and she'll go up with Allie, our pastry chef, and like be making something in the kitchen or tasting ice cream. You know, if I sit her down at the table, awesome. They're going to put a thing of raspberries in front of her because they know that she loves raspberries. Right. It's like she's a part of that. And that's what keeps the culture of the restaurant is very important, and that's what helps keep and maintain that culture.
All of that and much more with Tim on this week's episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, here with increasing frequency with my wife and co-host, Caitlin Friedman. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi, Andrew.
Okay. Our guest on today's episode is Tim Hollingsworth. Tim is the chef of OTM Restaurant, which is a wonderful restaurant in the Broad Museum in Los Angeles. We just ate there during our weekend of
extravaganza
debauchery for your birthday. We had lunch there.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Prior to that, Tim was the chef de cuisine at the French Laundry. We'll properly introduce him in a moment. But before we do that, we have to address what happened this morning. Friends of mine have told me not to address it. They said, ignore it. But I don't believe in that.
Well, it's one way to go. I don't believe in it either.
So Here's what happened. If you listen to the show all the way to the end, which a lot of people don't listen to podcasts all the way to the end, but at the very end of the last episode, just a couple days ago, I alluded to the fact that I was waiting with anticipation for the New York Times book review that I knew was about to break online. That happened. We're recording this Wednesday night. That happened this morning, first thing this morning, 6 a.m., I think, when I woke up. I had a Google alert, and the review had broken. I did not know who was going to write that review. It turned out it was written by Pete Wells, who is the New York Times restaurant reviewer of the last several years. Pete and I have emailed a couple of times, not in a long time. I've never met Pete Wells. you know, it was a mixed review. I am loath to comment on a review of my own stuff, but I'll do that in a second. But here's what people might find interesting. It was a mixed review. What was particularly negative were the opening paragraphs. And I was that guy today. So as someone who has a lot of friends who are chefs, as someone who used to be a publicist to chefs, chefs get reviews, right? And most chefs have had a bad review. I got texts from many of these people today. And the tendency is you want to make somebody feel better, right? So you want to send them an email and point out like the three or four good lines and da-da. I had zero interest in that today. In fact, first email I sent this morning was I shared the review with all the people at my publishing house and said, guys, the tendency at moments like this is to call out like, you know, the best lines and just please let's not do that. It's okay. I'm fine. It's fine. All the other reviews have been great. But I was that guy today. It was a weird feeling. I went for a long hike. It ended up being like a 9-mile hike this morning just to kind of think through the review. And there were moments where I'd catch someone kind of looking at me and I'd go like, oh, do they recognize me? Are they thinking about the review? We live in the suburbs. You know, like in New York City, that's possible. Unlikely here.
Highly unlikely.
Highly unlikely here. Oh, and then I had lunch with a bunch of food writer friends today.
Were they all talking about it?
We talked about it. At one point, I actually had to bring it up. You know, nobody brought it up.
Yeah.
I brought it up. I don't want to speak for any of them or mention who they were or what they said. But here is the one thing I will say, because – and it seems to be a consensus viewpoint amongst the few people I spoke to today. The review opens with some paragraphs that take on or apply the question of the Me Too moment to my book. Okay, largely because of the title, which is Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, which, as I think everybody knows, is a play on sex and drugs and rock and roll, which is a phrase associated with the era that the book covers. And this, to me, and I've thought about what I wanted to say about it, so this is actually a carefully chosen word. That was shitty. It was shitty because this book was put to bed last year. It was put to bed before the stories broke. And any professional writer knows that, okay? And anybody editing book reviews knows that. So, you know, to kind of connect the book to something that it's not about, to something that nobody was writing about, to kind of hang that around my neck and around the neck of the book.
But more than that, it hung it around the neck of all the chefs of that generation. That was the issue that I had with that review.
Okay, well, I'll let you say what you want in a minute, but I don't want to intertwine them because I think I can only sound defensive if I get into my feelings about the review.
Right.
Everyone's entitled to their opinion, but I actually believe what I'm saying right now is an objective statement, right? Anybody who writes professionally at the level of the person who reviewed this book knows that books are put to bed months in advance. And I will actually – I don't think I've ever said this publicly. I have said it in a few notes, including the other day to a listener of this show. It's Instagram message exchange. They said, I'm surprised Mario Batali was in your book. And I said, well, you know, when – the news broke about Mario, the book was quote-unquote on press. I couldn't change anything. I did take his name off the flap copy. I mean, people who have a galley of the book or, you know, an early review copy on the back cover of that book, he was actually mentioned. On the final copy and the promotional copy that's on Amazon and all that, his name was removed. That I was able to do. I wasn't able to remove him from the book. I don't know that I would have removed him 100% because he was around. But this is also kind of annoying to me. He is a very small character in the book because the book ends as he was just ascending. And one of the people who's quoted in this review of the more than 200 people I interviewed for the book was Mario. So that whole element of the review, that strain of the review, to me, was unfortunate. It was disappointing. And I think that, again, is an objective statement. So that's all I'm going to say about it. I was not happy about that part of the review. The rest of the review is his opinion, and everyone's entitled to their opinion. You got, the first book I ever did was the Gotham Bar and Grill Cookbook. And I remember the first bad review we got, there weren't many. I remember very distinctly Alfred Portale saying to me, you got to take the bad with the good, you know? And that was the first thing I ever wrote. And that always stayed with me, and I think that is true. So I don't disparage anybody, their feedback. And there were actually one or two points in the review that I don't disagree with. But I thought the way it was framed, I thought bringing Harvey Weinstein into it is just, again, I just thought it was a shitty thing. I really thought it was unfortunate. Say what you will about the book, evaluate it. But to bring these, to me, external things into it, which were not being bandied about when the book was put to bed, is just, I don't know, that part of it really irked me. But you say what you want to say about it, but I don't want to linger on it. I set this up at the end of the last episode, so now I feel like we had to address it here.
No, I mean, I hear you. I agree with all of that. I guess, you know, his issue with the title was something that I thought was unnecessary. I mean, anyone who's published a book knows a title gets picked, you know, months, if not years in advance of publication. So he knows that. And again, I just felt pinning it to this moment that we're in that is a necessary moment, but a very culturally and, you know, it's a painful time right now, the workplace between men and women. And just to pin your book, which has nothing to do with that, it was written before we were even actually ready to talk about it, is unfair.
Okay.
Okay.
Well,
we can move on.
I've said what I have to say about it. Right. I will say this. If you, more than ever, guys, a lot of people listen to the show. If you enjoyed the book, review it, Instagram it. I would particularly appreciate it this week. And if you haven't bought the book yet, I would particularly appreciate it if you ordered the book. See what you think for yourself. It's a big moment for a writer to be reviewed in the New York Times. The New York Times is, you know, that's the one you want, right? Mm-hmm. And for it to open with all that and then a Harvey Weinstein joke, I just think anybody deserves better than that. You know, I recently was talking about tennis players with somebody because a journalist had sort of misrepresented a Serena Williams press conference. They had taken words that she said, mm-hmm. described them on Twitter, and it's actually funny because it was actually a New York Times writer, described them on Twitter and indicated in a way that wasn't really accurate. The words were accurate, but they weren't said in a way that was described in this tweet, right? Mm. And I was talking to a friend about it, and I said, you know, I think there are writers who see the people they cover as three-dimensional human beings, mm-hmm. and I think there are writers who see the people they cover as just material, yeah. you know? And I feel like this moment that this book is in was just treated like material, just fodder for, you know, a catchy first paragraph and a Harvey Weinstein joke.
He's trying to make that book a story.
And I guess.
Actually not the story.
No. So it is what it is. You know,
right.
There's some good news about the book coming up before long that I can't announce yet, but there's plenty of great stuff happening and the PR campaign continues. And that's the last I'll say about it. So Tim Hollingsworth, drastically changing the subject. Tim yeah. Hollingsworth. So Timmy was the chef of the French Laundry for a couple of years, but his whole career, Tim is really unusual in this regard. And we talk about this in the interview. But Tim grew up in Northern California, got a job in a kitchen, fell in love with cooking, made it his mission to get into the French Laundry, got a job at the French Laundry, spent basically pre-Otium his entire career at the Laundry. He rose from commis or prep cook all the way up to chef de cuisine. I mean, it is amazing. And I loved his food. And he was, but he had nothing to do with this, really. I wrote a book about the Bocuse d'Or, the international cooking competition, the year that Tim competed. And I had been given permission to write the book by the people running the competition, Thomas Keller and Daniel Balloud and Jerome Bocuse. And then Tim won the competition to represent the U.S. And in addition to all the pressures of being the U.S. candidate in the competition, oh, by the way, here's a guy who's writing a book about this, and he's going to be like in your face and being a fly on the wall for, you know, the whole time you're doing this. And Tim was amazing. He was amazing. I mean, he gave me so – you remember.
Yeah, he was really generous with his time.
Generous with his time, generous with his honesty, generous with his understanding of what I needed at a time that was incredibly stressful for him. And I will always, Tim, always be grateful to you for that. And despite the pressure cooker of that, or maybe because of it, of that situation, he ended up coming in sixth place, which, given how much time he had to prepare, was actually quite a feat. It was amazing. I could watch Tim cook all day. I mean, I remember watching him. I would watch these five-hour practice sessions, me with my notebook, just sitting there, and the way he moved around the kitchen. I mean, he was really something, and still is, obviously. Moved to Los Angeles, opened Otium, which, as we said before, is in the Broad Museum. And it's a beautiful restaurant. It has an enormous menu. It has a very high-energy open kitchen. Well, what were your impressions? We went there for lunch on our birthday weekend.
I just loved everything about – first of all, the space was great.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful yet kind of comforting and homey at the same time. I don't exactly know why. Maybe it's the colors of the woods. I don't know. But the dishes were incredibly rich and flavorful, but not overwhelming. The flavors didn't compete with each other. It was kind of a perfect lunch.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
It's great. I've been there several times now. It's I'm a big fan of it. Anyway, I was in town promoting Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, which I still think is a great title. And I was why, you don't think so? Why would no one think so? It's a great title. And I was in town promoting the book. Tim and I got together at his apartment, although he's just moved into a house. I found out today on Instagram.
Aww,
he just moved into a house.
That's
he bought
so
a beautiful
nice.
Grill. He's built a sandbox for his kids. Amazing. But I went to his apartment on a Saturday afternoon, and we hung out for a little bit. We caught up, and then we set up, you know, the mics and the recorder. And I forgot to take a picture, so he just had someone take a picture of him today. I said, make it look like you're sitting at a table talking to someone, and he did. So that's the episode photo. But this was done at his home, and his now former home, this lofty apartment that he and his family were living in. And I don't think I need to say anything more about it. But, you know, Tim is just a very soft-spoken, what you see is what you get, modest guy who is just massively, massively talented, as anyone would be who spent more than 10 years at the French Laundry and became the chef de cuisine. And as anyone can eat at Otium can see for themselves. So that is it. And with that, I'm going to invite people to pretend that you were in Los Angeles, that you came to Tim's apartment building, got buzzed in, took the elevator up to his floor, came down the hall, found the door open, as you might if there was like a party or something going on, came in, rounded the corner, and you see me and Tim in this sun-drenched apartment in Los Angeles on a Saturday afternoon, getting ready to sit down and do an interview. And with that, here you go. Tim just busted out a ceramic, two-tone ceramic, I want to call that a goblet. A modern goblet.
Yeah, it's this is actually from Iga, Japan.
Yeah.
In Iga, Japan, they have special ceramics. That's where like the danabes that you see are from as well.
Yeah.
They are specially engineered to keep something colder. So you keep it in the freezer, and if you can see the bubbles that they have,
yeah,
like the head on it, it makes it much finer in your mouth.
So is that
it's
right?
Very delicate, yeah.
And it stays colder longer.
Way longer. It's actually incredible how cold it'll stay.
I have to touch this. Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's cool. No pun intended. So Tim, I know you from your Napa days at the French Laundry, but how long have you been in LA now?
I've been in LA since 2013.
Okay, so about 5 years.
Yeah.
I feel like you've become a total Los Angelino. Were you always? I feel like maybe you always were.
Is that a compliment? Or
yeah, it's a compliment. No, my wife and I, we don't talk about this publicly, but my wife and I constantly think about trying to engineer a situation where we could become like what we refer to as LA snowbirds,
mm-hmm.
like check out for the winter and come, but not go to Florida where I'm from.
Yeah.
Come here.
I know we've talked about that a little bit.
Have I mentioned that to you? Yeah. We talk about it a lot. Like that is like a life goal for us.
There's a lot of tennis out here too, right?
There's tennis out here too. But we just love it here.
Yeah.
I mean, I really love it here. But you feel, I don't know. I mean, you used to surf.
Yeah, I still do.
You still do?
Yeah. Not as often as when I lived in Napa.
Yeah.
With children now and stuff like that, it's very different. Life is different.
Yeah. But I mean, what was the beginnings for you of deciding to move here? Like how long before you did it were you sort of pondering this is maybe where you'd end up?
I think it was about in 2011, I started to talk to Thomas about leaving. And I left 2012, 2013.
Yeah.
And you know, New York, San Francisco was kind of saturated with a lot of, it had several chefs that had gone through Thomas Keller Regiment. New York, and it was very familiar in a sense of like, you know, I used to go there on my weekends, you know, almost every week, you know, for a long time.
San Francisco.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I spent a lot of time there. I was very comfortable there. And then New York was something that was a little bit like, it would be a mission, you know. I mean, I rented a house in Napa. Yeah. Like, I had stuff. I had belongings. Yeah. I would have to kind of sell everything and then move to a small apartment, you know, like the whole kind of New York thing. And L.A. was a place that I told myself I would actually never move to.
Really?
I just didn't think that they appreciated food. But you're talking, you know, 15 years ago that I would say that, 20 years ago.
So, had you spent time here at that point?
I mean, I would come down here and, you know, go to, like, Chateau Montmartre and, like, you know, or every summer I would come down here when I was a kid, and we would go to Disneyland, Universal Studios, Knott's Berry Farm, all that kind of stuff. But like in my adult days, I just felt that what real LA restaurants have you heard of? What real LA chefs have you heard of? It, you know, people didn't seem to give restaurants that sort of longevity, you know, mm-hmm. and people were much about like what's happening now and what's the new spot and the mm-hmm. scene. That was my perception. It was very Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think it's completely different. And at the time that I moved down here and thinking about moving down here, it was incredibly different. It was, I would argue that it was probably the land of opportunity as far as, you know, opening up a restaurant.
Because why? I mean, I think I know why, but why would you say?
I mean, there's still the opportunity for younger chefs to open up a restaurant on their own.
You mean financially it's more feasible here?
Yeah. I mean, what you think about New York, maybe, you know, 15 years ago, you would have places like Degustation that opened up, you know, and it's like, you know, it's a really good cook, like that opened up a restaurant and now is a chef and like did his thing. And it's like, he does something cool. And he had inexpensive rent and like, you know, it was the opportunity to do that and not be like overpowered by, you know, the bigger business, the bigger chefs, was there in New York. And I think it was the same. And, here in LA, you can go to a strip mall in Koreatown still and get, you know, good spot.
Yeah.
And you do see those, you know, those people try to do the restaurants. I mean, think of Alma that opened up here. That was like in a little hole in the wall across the street from the Standard or the Ace, I think. I don't know. It's just there's still the opportunity. Now you have a lot more chefs moving here.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible, actually.
And people coming down from San Francisco now.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, those two, to me, there was much more openness between New York and L.A. than between L.A. and San Francisco.
If you're from San Francisco, you don't like L.A.
You look down on L.A.
Yes, and but if you're from L.A., I don't think L.A. people didn't necessarily like Northern California people, perspective.
I think they perceive the snobbishness. So I think it's a response to that.
Yeah, for sure.
No?
Yeah, for sure.
I think they could feel that.
Okay, you guys don't like demeanor, us, so forget about you.
Yeah, that's always been my impression.
Yeah.
But I have always felt like L.A. was culinarily undervalued. I feel like that's always been true.
Yeah, I mean, I think the value in culinary food in L.A. is the little places. It's the, I mean, I can take you to go get the best fish taco right now. You know, I can go and
take
you.
Would that be a restaurant or a truck?
They have two. They have a location. It's a freestanding restaurant, and then they have a truck. Yeah, uh-huh. Ricky's Fish Tacos. Okay. I think it's incredible.
Yeah. What's so great about it?
It's just like, it's cheap, it's fast, and it's as good. It's as good as I can make it. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? It's like, yeah. I'm trying to think of like a better way to do it. Of course you can use a little bit better of a tortilla or whatever, right. but you know, they do a tremendous job. It's a crispy thing. I can walk down the street at night here yeah. and grab a taco,
yeah.
A quarter of a mile away,
uh-huh.
you know? Yeah. And I can walk the opposite direction and do the same thing actually.
Yeah. yeah. So can we talk about your evolution for a little bit? Yeah. You and I had an accelerated, well, it was kind of a one-way thing because I got to know you very quickly. You mm-hmm, got to know mm-hmm. me more over the years since then. But you were the subject, basically the protagonist of a book I wrote, almost with no say in the matter, if we're honest. I think we can say that this many years later.
Yeah.
You were the candidate, they call it,
mm-hmm.
which means the United States representative to the Bocuse d'Or cooking competition, the year that I wrote Knives at Dawn. Before you got that gig, I had been given permission to write a book. All of a sudden, my fate as a writer was tied to you and yeah. I getting along. We hit it off pretty quickly.
Yeah, definitely.
And all of a sudden, you had this guy, after you were putting in these insanely long practice sessions, you know, sitting down with a tape recorder over dinner and asking you 3 hours of questions about your life and the stress of the competition. You're smiling as I say this. Well, first of all, is it weird for you to be sitting here with me with a tape recorder again? We probably haven't done this in almost a decade.
This is true. I didn't even think about that. But yeah,
Is it weird?
I don't think it's weird. I think it's very comfortable. You know,
I mean,
we just met up in New York. And,
yeah, no, we've socialized. Yeah,
yeah, that was very enjoyable for me.
It was great.
We
spent like
yeah.
3 hours together.
Yeah, yeah. You know, a couple cups of coffee. It was awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, so it feels very natural.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now, I always thought of you. I was surprised when I first got to know you because my initial impression of you was as a fairly, I don't know if I want to, I think shy a little bit, certainly in terms of having, I mean, you weren't a chef yet. I mean, you were a sous chef.
Yeah.
You were soon to be the chef at the French Laundry. Mm-hmm. But you were kind of thrust into the public eye with that cooking competition.
Yeah.
But something that really stunned me back then was how open you were when we would talk. Has that always come naturally to you?
Yeah, I come from a very like small family, small town.
Yeah.
And I think I'm just naturally pretty open. I think I've actually learned or tried to learn to be a little bit more reserved as I get older.
Strategically.
Strategically. Yeah. I mean, you know, you
sometimes
don't want
to
put yourself
just smart
out there.
To keep your mouth. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, I'm very open in a sense of like, you know, trusting. You're gonna ask me a question, I wanna answer it honestly, you
right.
know?
Right.
Not really thinking about like, you know, what would be the benefit or
the ramifications
of that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So you just mentioned a small town. Tell people where you grew up.
I grew up on Huggy Bear Lane uh-huh. in Grizzly Flat, California, which is about 30 minutes east of Placerville, California. Placerville is Hangtown. It's in between Sacramento and Lake Tahoe, kind of where the gold rush happened.
Okay. Okay. And you, we don't have to go beat by beat, but you worked for a restaurant up there.
Yeah.
And then you went on a mission, basically, to get into the French Laundry.
Yes.
And you kind of, I mean, I think of you, I don't know if I ever said this to you, but when I was getting to know you and I would describe you to people, I described you almost in, it was like biblical terms. Like I thought of you as like the little baby Moses, you know, arriving at the French Laundry. Because you basically, with the exception of a few stages, that's where you grew up as a chef. I mean, as a cook.
Yeah,
your whole career was there.
Yeah, I mean, I literally have worked for two chefs in my entire life.
Yeah, the chef you worked for as a teenager and Keller.
Yep.
That's amazing. Have you ever talked to other chefs about that? Do people find that unusual? Or
I mean, if you say you spent 13 years or something, people look at my age and whatever. I'm getting a little older now, but like people would say like 13 years, like, you know, you must have like been a teenager when you started there.
Right.
And, you know, I think people are very surprised. People, there's not that many chefs today, certainly today, but even as I was kind of coming up through the ranks, there's not a lot of chefs that would spend that much time with somebody.
Or anybody. Or that much time before they want to be a chef.
This is true, yeah.
Yeah. So I've been talking a lot about, because I just wrote this book, right, about mm-hmm. the Thomas's generation,
yeah.
right? And you know, people have been asking me, what's the difference between that generation? I mean, there's so many differences. And one of them, and I don't mean it as a dig, because I always say this, things change. Mm-hmm. And people need to understand that. But I do feel like more and more there's almost these two populations out there, broadly speaking. There's people like yourself mm-hmm. who come up in kitchen, like I'll call them the Michelin yeah. level kitchens, right? Who put in the time, who mm-hmm. want to just work, you know, put in years and years and years, become technically, you know, incredibly proficient and complete, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I think there's a whole other group of chefs, young cooks, who are really in a race to become chefs, own their own business. You know, you hear it all the time. I've heard it on this show a million times. I want to have a restaurant by the time I'm 30,
mm-hmm.
right? People, yeah. you just smiled wryly, I would say. do you feel like that's accurate? I feel like more than it used to be, there's almost these two camps out there.
Yeah, I mean, people have checklists in life, and checklists, they're good. You know, I wanted to be, you know, Marco Pierre White, I think, was 3 Michelin star chef when he was 27 years old. You know, I wanted to be, you know, that was my goal when I was young, yeah. you know, when I was a young, like sort of, I want to say arrogant, but, you know, like a young, naive sort of 21, 22 year old. And I'm, you know, cooking next to John Fraser, Corey Lee, Eric Siebold,
Grant.
Like all, you know, Grant Achatz. Yeah. All of these guys, you know, I was the guy that was like, you know, this is what I'm going to accomplish. This is what I'm going to do.
Right.
Not really knowing how to do it or what it right. even meant for that matter.
Right.
But you know, I am pleased to say that, you know, no, I wasn't a chef of a 3 Michelin star restaurant at 27, but of my own restaurant, which was my goal. But at 29, you know, I took over the realms, or the reins at the French Laundry, which was, you know, which was pretty cool.
That was a big deal.
Yeah, that was, yeah. you know,
yeah.
especially for a kid that was hired by accident.
Do you want to tell that story?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was 4 years. No, it was before Per Se opened. So 3 years. 3 years into the job, we, you know, every year after Christmas, after New Year's dinner, we sit down and we have, you know, we blow out the food. We eat everything. We eat the leftover truffles and foie gras and all of these different things because we're closing for 2 weeks for renovations mm-hmm. or for something like that. It's our winter break. That time's a great time to tell stories, you know, reminisce about the past. Some people have worked there for a few years, months. Some people have worked there, you know, since the beginning, you know.
Right.
Which is cool to hear all the different stories and stuff yeah. like that. So, you know, I hear stories that, you know, about people that I've never even met,
yeah.
you know, even still today. And Eric Siebold stood up and he basically told
a
story.
We should say Eric is he still, I don't even know, is he still in D.C.?
He's still in D.C., yeah. Okay. He just recently opened up a restaurant.
Yeah, so the
chef
who
very well.
Was at the Laundry when you were, and then
yeah,
became
he was a chef
in his
cuisine.
Own right. Yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
And he told a story and he basically said, you know, I was hired by accident. And I was, you know, I honestly was very embarrassed of the story at the time. Now I can kind of laugh at it, but,
yeah.
but you know, like, it was, you know, it's embarrassing to be hired by accident. But once you become the chef de cuisine, then you can
right.
kind of tell that story and be like, yeah, you know, I was actually hired by accident, but then became the chef de cuisine. How ironic is that?
Right. But what was the story? You basically what we would now call stalked Keller by phone.
Yeah. I mean,
you kept calling. You wanted to work there.
Yeah. I mean, I called, made a reservation,
right.
I mean, which is not the easiest thing to do mm-hmm. in the first place. And then I made sure that Thomas was going to be there on that day.
Yeah.
So I said, you know, then, you know, once I had dinner afterwards, I went to the kitchen. I handed him my resume.
Yeah.
Said, hey, I would like a job here, chef.
Yeah.
Like, what can I do? He handed me his business card. Like, I'm sure he's done 1,000 times.
Sure.
And I called and I called and I called and it's the kitchen line. And you know, I would call and Eric would pick up the phone and he'd be like, you know, I didn't know who it was at the time, but he'd be like, no, can I take a message? And I had called so many times that I would be embarrassed to like say,
yeah,
yeah, no, this is Tim again.
Right.
So, but eventually I was presented the opportunity to do a stage, come out, try for a position. And I went, I tried out, and then I called and I called and I called. And finally, I received a letter in the mail that said, you've been hired. I still have that letter.
Right.
I should frame it. It's in,
it's in my
storage. But yeah, it was a cool thing. And Thomas basically said yes, and Eric said no.
Right.
And as a glitch in the paperwork, I was hired.
Yeah.
They actually didn't have a position for me when I landed. I mean, there was two people essentially on the same job, but for whatever reason, I would like to think it was my work ethic or something like that. That I mean, I was in over my head. This is the French Laundry. You know, I was in the minors. Now here I am, like playing in a World Series.
Went to the show. So I need to ask you a few questions about that time in your life. First of all, why don't you, because I think this is interesting to people who don't understand the business, this part of the business, which is you alluded to becoming the chef de cuisine at the French Laundry, right? So a lot of people know the French Laundry as a Thomas Keller restaurant, right? Mm-hmm. What did that, because I remember very distinctly, Corey Lee had been the chef before you, and I remember eating a tasty menu there when Corey was the chef, and I remember eating the menu when you became the chef, and they were very... They all were in the French Laundry lane. They were very different experiences. Can you talk about the latitude someone like you had at that time in your life to make the menu or the experience reflective of yourself while still being true to sort of the overall mission of the restaurant? Because I think that's something that's very hard for lay people to understand.
Yeah, I mean, I think the general idea of it is that Thomas is very trusting, and he's a great mentor, but he gives you, you know, you run the kitchen, you're the chef de cuisine, you run the kitchen. When he was the chef de cuisine there, you know, when he was the chef in the kitchen every day, I mean, the guy was the hardest working guy, you know, you can imagine. He still is a very hard working guy.
Yeah.
You know, he would work lunch and dinner, and then after dinner, he'd be breaking down the fish for the next day. The guy he's an animal.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, I think it was a little bit unique in the sense that I hadn't worked at a lot of different places. So I essentially grew up there.
Yeah.
So yes, I had like my own ideas about food and my own history of food, but professionally speaking, you know, it's not like I had like recipes from when I worked at Danielle or Jean-Georges or, you know, like all these.
You didn't have like that notebook with like.
No.
Yeah, all these different influences.
No, I really didn't. So, you know, I would say that I was an anomaly in that situation. But yeah, I mean, Corey drove the restaurant in his own way. He's an unbelievably talented chef.
Yeah.
I mean, he really drove the restaurant in a weird way. I mean, I think he did it. If you think about what the French Laundry was and then where Corey took it, Corey was the first person that really kind of was able, Thomas allowed him to put his footprint on that restaurant. I mean, there was nobody before him. He's the first chef de cuisine outside of Thomas being in the kitchen.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, Corey, you know, I'm sure went through all the hiccups, and Corey's a different nationality than me. I mean, I'm American. Thomas is American. Corey has a very Korean background.
And
you know,
brought that onto the menu.
He did. He brought that Asian influence on the menu. And I think that he probably, you know, it's like having an older sibling. You know, if I got in trouble a lot as a kid, my parents were a little bit more lenient probably with my younger brother, right? And I think that Corey kind of paved the way for me. And for me, it was a lot easier because the food that I know and the style that I knew was what Corey was cooking, but also what, you know, the Thomas Keller was cooking.
Right.
So for me, I think it was an easier transition in the sense of, you know, I think Thomas was very trusting just because I mean, that's what I knew. That's how I went.
Yeah.
But he gives you unbelievable latitude, you know, and I think that's the benefit of the French Laundry. When I was 21 years old there, I just started, and I moved to the cheese station, Chef de Partie. And I'm putting dishes on the menu as a 21 year old kid that had barely any experience. You may say like, oh, that's, you know, why would he allow you to do that? It's because he helps take the ideas that you had and formulate them into what they should be, or what a three Michelin star, what French Laundry, you know, somebody coming to the French Laundry would expect. And, that's where he was very, very talented. And I think that same philosophy, is so important and is why I spent so long there.
You know what's funny as you're saying this? This is real inside baseball between you and me. But, you know, one of my most vivid memories of that book I wrote was a night that I came. There's some pictures of it in the book.
Mm-hmm.
The night that you put up a version of the platter you were going to present at the Bocuse d'Or.
Uh-huh.
And it was just you and your commis, Adina Guest, and Thomas. And I was standing there just like with a tape recorder, or maybe my notebook. And he was giving you feedback mm-hmm. on the various, I don't know if you remember this. Mm-hmm. There was that little globe sort of dish that I think held a scallop. What was in that on the seafood on the seafood one?
We ended up using that on the beef.
Anyway, he had this idea of taking like maybe like a parsley, like a coulis or something, and uh-huh. rotating it so that the parsley, the pureed parsley would like coat the glass.
Uh huh.
And, you know, it was just stuff like that. Yeah. But it was with the flavors that you already had there.
Yep.
That was you're smiling big when I say this. That's kind of like what you're describing at the restaurant.
Yeah, I love that.
That was amazing to watch.
Yeah.
It was amazing to watch because he wasn't trying to make your food into something else. He 100%. Was trying to, like a good editor, as a writer, I would say this is what good editors do. There's mm-hmm. editors who sort of impose their own style on you.
Uh-huh.
And then there's editors who see what you are going for, what you could be,
yeah.
even if you don't really fully get it, mm-hmm. and bring that out of you, yeah. right? And that's what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, that's what makes him... That's not the entirety of, you know, why he's so successful, but that's one of the hugest reasons. I think he's incredible at doing that. And I think, honestly, I think I'm very good at doing that now. That's something that I do with the cooks, with the sous chefs, and with the chef de cuisine that I have is that same sort of thing. And I learned it from him 100%.
Yeah. So, okay, this is be honest with me here.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really have wondered about this. You and I never talked about it. You spent all those years at the French Laundry. No one even has to say to me what the pressures are. Forget being the chef de cuisine, of just cooking in that kitchen mm-hmm. at any level. I think being a prep cook in that kitchen, a commis, right?
Yeah.
The exactitude of that kitchen, the expectations of the diners on a daily basis. You rise to the level of chef de cuisine. Eventually, you decide you're going to move on, okay? What was the period of decompression, recalibration? Like when your first day where you know you're not going back into that kitchen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you take me through the stages of the months that followed that? Because I have to think... I almost think of it as like what it must be when you're like stop being president of the United States,
mm-hmm.
you know, like to not have all that on you just had a look on your face like, yeah, it kind of is like that.
Yeah. I mean,
but take me through that. What was that like? What kind of relief, what kind of, buyer's remorse that you had, you know, leapt out of one of the best restaurants in the world? Like just what were the stages?
I mean, I essentially left without a job. I didn't have a job. I found a place where I was going to consult in LA that somebody had introduced me to, and I was going to stay with one of their family members until I found a place. Okay. So I pretty much moved to LA right away.
What's right away?
I mean, like within weeks. Uh-huh. I mean, a week or two. I'm literally probably that week I left.
And what was that week like though? I mean, were you just laying around like?
No, I was on to the next thing. I mean, I was...
You were right back to work.
No, I mean, I keep myself busy. So, like, I was on... Like, I had just met a girl. Not just met a girl, but I had met her probably 6 to 8 months before mm-hmm. that. And she lived in L.A. She's now my wife. Uh-huh. We have a couple kids together. But she, you know, so that was, like, a big part of what I was doing at the time. Then I was coming down here consulting. And then I was just really kind of decompressing and... Honestly, not working, not thinking about food, not looking at, you know, I don't know, just removing myself from it. It was a lot. I mean, it's a lot of pressure and it's a lot of time. Yeah. And you're working for someone else in their environment and you have to ask yourself, who are you at that point? You know,
you mean as a chef?
And as a person, you know,
and
like,
as a person,
I mean, like,
because you had spent so much time, right? Because it's not just the food there, it's the whole.
Yeah, I mean, Thomas Keller is
a lifestyle.
And it's a mentality. It's like, it's how they, you know, it's like they have it's like a, not a cult, you know, in a negative sense, but it's, you know, it's this place, you know, they have, I don't know. And coming down here, it was very much like, okay. Understanding that Thomas Keller is probably the most successful chef of our generation of this time in life. He has had the greatest reach and has been incredible. and influence on an enormous amount of people.
Right.
I think that looking at him and the success that he had, understanding, you know, what that was, I really was asking myself, what do I want? You know, what is success to me? And I don't know that I could have defined that at that point in time.
I was going to say, was it hard for you to be even in touch with that? And I would imagine it would be.
It was. Well, I mean, yeah,
you were
kind of
like a soldier.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, 100%.
It was all kind of giving yourself over to the organism.
Mm-hmm.
Am I making sense?
Yeah, definitely.
That is what it was like.
It's very much like that. Yeah. And now it's, you know, before, throughout that couple year difference between that and opening Otium,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I had to sort of decompress, figure out who I was as a person, figure out what I wanted in life. I knew that, you know, I wanted kids. I wanted, you know,
yeah.
I wanted a wife. I wanted family. That was a very important thing to me.
Yeah.
Then, you know, opening up Otium, it was like a huge question of, what is a restaurant? What do I want a restaurant to be?
How did you go about figuring that out for yourself?
I think it was trying to figure out what success meant to me. And success to me would have been balance. It's balance at the, you know, I want to have kids. I want to have a wife. I want to have a restaurant. I want to have a career. I want to be successful. But that balance is what kind of kept everything going. That balance creates longevity for me personally.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's all about that balance. But the process of opening up Otium was very much like just really thinking about what is a restaurant? I mean, French Onion is a bucket list restaurant. You have people coming over there that are coming from around the world to eat there.
Yeah. People don't understand. People think of that restaurant as a high roller restaurant. More than per se in New York, that restaurant to me, because of where it is,
yeah.
the many weeks I spend hanging around you guys and observing, it was so kind of cute to me. There were these people who clearly were there. You could tell there were people who, they weren't wearing very super expensive clothes.
Yep.
It was like a once in a lifetime, it was like a pilgrimage.
100%.
And they were going to eat there probably once ever, maybe once, maybe twice if they were lucky.
Yeah.
They were so excited to be there.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like a spiritual experience for a lot of those people.
Yeah. I mean, we had a tremendous amount of regulars, but, you know, there are a ton of first-time diners that are coming, you know, or a ton of people that, you know, might come to the Napa Valley, you know, periodically for vacation or whatever, and they're coming there and they're scheduling their trip around the reservation that they got at the French Laundry.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's not New York City where, you know, you have people just driving up
or
that live in the area.
Or the density of just money.
Money, exactly.
Both residential and visitors.
Power lunch.
No, I remember once I ate it per se and there was these people walked in. And the first, right away, they started asking the waiter about, or the captain about altering the menu, right?
Mm-hmm.
Their menu. And I was like, I was almost taken aback.
Yeah.
Because I had been around the laundry so much, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't remember ever seeing that. But it wasn't like, would they mind or I have an allergy? It was like they were acting like they were in any other restaurant.
Yeah.
Which I guess at some level, okay, you're paying a lot of money. Maybe that's okay. But I was like, there wasn't the reverence for the experience that I associate with the French Laundry. You know, or watching people come back. Anyway, we've talked enough about your last gig. But figuring out what you wanted in terms of a restaurant, figuring out who you were on the plate, right, as I like to say. How did you go about that process? Had you been doing that while you were still at the French Laundry, or was there no mental space for that?
I had been doing that, but all within the rules of the French Laundry.
Uh-huh.
So while a lot of dishes were very much my signature dishes there that I would be running as the chef de cuisine,
right.
You know, there wasn't, it was still within this, still within the same, like, footprint or the guideline, the template that the French Laundry has. I mean, it's a 9-course tasting menu.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, for the VIP guests, they're going to get something at the beginning, soup, caviar, fish, custard, kind of, you know, like that whole deal. And, you know, so for me, it was like asking myself, okay, what is the progression? And how do you, you know, from coming from a only tasting menu sort of place, how do you do more casual food?
Yeah. So when you get to LA and you have some time in your own space and I don't mean your own restaurant space, mental space and just all this freedom and oxygen, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did you go about, like, did you start testing things at home? Were you just sitting around thinking about menu items? Like, were you dining around a lot? Like, how were you coming to what ended up being what you do at Otium?
I mean, I dined around a little bit here in L.A. I initially wanted to open up a taco restaurant. So in my house, I was doing a lot of different salsas and playing around with tacos and whatnot. I did consulting a little bit. So I consulted in Korea and in Lebanon, which kind of led me into the direction of like a sort of a food, you know, the French Laundry. Yes, we did. We had a template that we had to follow, but there were no guidelines. If I wanted to do something that was Korean on a menu or Chinese on a menu influence, I could do that. And, I love that liberty. So it's something that I wanted to have at OTM as well. So, I mean, in thinking about what OTM was, it was what I wanted in within a restaurant, what I wanted, as far as, you know, my life growing up, my first job that I had in a restaurant was incredibly influential. It's why I'm cooking still today, is because of, you know, the influence that they had on me.
Yeah.
And that was a mom and pop place, and the kids were running around. And if you go to OTM on the right day, you know, my little kids are running around.
Is that right?
And my wife is there. Yeah. I mean, and all the employees, they know, you know, like I can literally drop my daughter off there and she'll go up with Allie, our pastry chef, and like be making something in the kitchen or tasting ice cream. You know, if I sit her down at the table, they're going to put a thing of raspberries in front of her because they know that she loves raspberries. Right. It's like she's a part of that. And that's what keeps the culture of the restaurant is very important. And that's what helps keep and maintain that culture. I mean, it keeps that sort of family vibe in the restaurant.
Right.
And I love that.
That's great. Family was all, I remember family always being really important to you.
It's very important. Yeah.
You're close with your siblings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredibly important. I don't know. It's just something they're always there. They always will be there. It was, and you know what? I feel a little bit of guilt and as a brother, you know, as a son a little bit too, because I left and pursued something that, you know, was working at the French Laundry, and being a chef, which, you know, took me away from my family. I wasn't there when any of my brothers were in high school. I was, you know, working at the French Laundry. I wasn't there when my sister was in high school.
Have most of them stayed close to home?
Every one of them live very close to home.
Okay.
Except for my brother, Brian, who went to Vegas and worked in Vegas for many years and now lives in L.A.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Brian helped me open up OTM, was at Barrel and Ashes for a little bit. And he was, at one point in time, he was running the beverage program. So, started out as a manager, floor manager.
Right.
But you know, it's, and that to me is very important too. It's just having one sibling close, you know, I love that.
That's great.
So tomorrow's Sunday and I'll probably spend Sunday with my family. You know, I'll have my brother, I'll text him to come over and be like, hey, let's make tri-tip or let's do something.
Right.
And he'll play with the kids and we'll, you know, it's, I don't know. I just love that.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
Welcome back to the show. We will return you in just a moment to our interview with Tim Hollingsworth, recorded in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago. Caitlin, I am going to keep this mid-show break short. I want to get people back to the interview. We talked a lot in the intro.
Mm-hmm.
I will just make my usual weekly plea. If you enjoy this show, the two best ways to keep up with it are by subscribing on iTunes or Stitcher, or by following the show. The handle is @ChefPodcast on Instagram. I do an alert the minute the shows go up. and there's always a link in the bio, but it's much more practical just to subscribe and then they show up in your feed. Although I will say I'm amazed how many people I find do not know how to use their podcast apps. You're making a face.
Well, I'm making a face because you actually had to show me how to use it.
Did I have to show you?
Yeah, because I didn't know either.
I can't tell you how many people they're like, I love your show. I want to subscribe. I don't know how. And then I take their – you know, it's like when you put your phone number in someone's phone.
Yeah.
And I go, give me your phone, and I subscribe them. But I don't know if they even know how to find their way back into the app. It's crazy. And I mean, 30-year-olds have said to me, you know, well, I just go to the link on your Instagram and I go from there. I'm like, really? It's 2018. It's a lot easier to do stuff now. Anyway.
Okay.
I recommend you do that if you enjoy the show. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, but I'm about to lose that. Nobody's following that account. And if you enjoy the show, please throw us a rating or a review on iTunes. And again, I have a book out. Most people really enjoy it. And you can order my book and review that. I would be especially grateful for that this week. As I mentioned earlier in the show. And with that, we're going to get you back to Timmy's now former apartment, Tim Hollingsworth, and I, picking up our conversation from a few weeks ago on that beautiful, sunny, perfect Los Angeles afternoon. I hope you enjoy the rest of it. That is the sound of Tim pouring out the last of his beer.
That's pretty good.
Is it good?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
Tim, why don't you tell people, I've eaten there, but why don't you describe what OTM is to people?
OTM is what, I would say OTM is a great representation of what food in LA is, and the style. And it's that mean, and what America is. And America is just based on so many different cultures and ethnicities and people coming to a different area and creating their own cuisine based on the ingredients that the country has or the area has, region has. And ODM is trying to be that, is trying to be a representation of what that is.
But you brought up the LA thing. That's interesting. Was that, you? Do you think of it as kind of an amalgamation of what's,
I mean, LA.
Happens in LA?
LA, you want to go to, you know, you want Chinese food. Okay, let's go to San Gabriel Valley. You want Mexican food, East LA. You want Filipino food. Let's go, you know, like there's all of these different cuisines and ethnicities in this city. I mean, it's a very, very diverse city. And I think because of that, that's what LA food is. I mean, if you think about Jonathan Gold and what he writes about, I mean, it's all, he loves and celebrates the, you know, the ethnic food in the city, and he should. I mean, it's amazing.
You know, it's interesting. I never thought of this before, but when you were just talking, I was thinking about you coming here from where you came from.
Mm-hmm.
LA food is really, tell me if you disagree, because I just had this thought. It's the food that chefs eat. It's the off-hour food of chefs.
It very much is.
A lot of it.
It very much is.
It's ethnically pure. It's relatively simple and straightforward for the most. The stuff you were just describing, this is what most cooks eat after hours.
Yeah, I mean,
I always say even the most modernist chef, they don't break out the liquid nitrogen at home.
No,
nobody eats like that at home.
No,
I mean, chefs really appreciate simplicity and purity.
100%. Yes.
Isn't that a fair statement about LA?
For sure. I mean, yesterday when I woke up, I made breakfast tacos. For lunch, I ate at OTM. I don't remember what I ate.
Family meal or something off the menu?
I ate until family meal at like 4 o'clock. And at 4 o'clock, I had some sort of like Mexican dish. It was a Mexican dish that the guys made.
Okay.
Like a pozole type dish. Yeah. And then for dinner, I had Korean food.
Right.
And, you know.
At what kind of a place?
Takeout. And it was a Korean restaurant that was recommended by Korean friends. And it was really, really good. I had never had it before.
Yeah.
I never had that restaurant before. If I think about the different food that I eat in 1 week, it's incredible. I mean, it's never, my wife is Middle Eastern. I mean, I have Middle Eastern food all the time. Like I have, mm-hmm. I have literally bags of za'atar over there that came from Jordan. It was shipped specifically to give to me by friends.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's like, it's really, really incredible. I have sumac. I have Aleppo pepper, which is very, very hard to get from Aleppo. I mean, because I have Syrian friends and, you know, it's just, it's that food is what brings people together. I mean, I think everybody would kind of say that. And it's a one common denominator that, like, you know, all cultures have, everybody eats. Right. So I think with LA and just the different cultures that we have here, I think it's incredible. And I wanted Odium to feel that. And because of that, I wanted to have diversity in the clientele. You can walk into OTM tonight and you'll see, like, you know, hipsters next to people that might be going to a concert, right. next to people that might be celebrating something, next to like people from out of town. And it'll be, it's great to me. That's success because that's what I wanted to happen there. I'm not sure how I achieved it.
What do you mean by that?
I'm just like, you know, it's what I wanted and I put an effort to do that. I'm not sure what part of the equation made that happen. But we were, you know, we're able to get that. And I look around and I think like, wow, this is pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, I've only been there once. Mm-hmm. I'm going back tonight, as you know.
Yes.
But it was that. I mean, it is. First of all, it's a big space.
Yeah, it is.
It's got a lot of energy. Mm-hmm. There's an open kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
How many items are on your menu?
I think there's about 35, not including pastry.
How many of those are sort of like they're like full time, and how much of the menu changes?
I think we have about 5 or 6 dishes that have been on since day one.
That's it.
Yeah,
and the rest is in rotation or new stuff or whatever. Wow, so that's a lot of constant work on that level.
Yeah.
And how, when you first thought about the restaurant, how big a menu, do you remember, like, when you first started sketching out a menu, was it always going to be that big, or did you just kind of keep finding that you needed to add stuff on or wanting to add stuff on because of this idea you just mentioned, I mean, trying to bring all these influences in?
Yeah, I mean, I looked at the different menus in LA, and I'm thinking, like, oh my God, these guys have like 35 dishes. Somebody has 40 dishes. I'm like, the menus here are big. If you go to a lot of different restaurants, the menus are very big in LA, more so than New York and more so than San Francisco. People come in all the time and they're like, oh my God, your menu's so big.
Yeah.
But they're not from LA. People from LA, they're not going to say that it's big.
Yeah.
They're not. I wish we could do less. Sometimes I think about going into to do less, but essentially we built it based on that and the way that the rotation works within the menu. Like each station will have like 4 or 5 dishes.
That's the organizing principle.
Yeah.
That's how you make it achievable.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So, you know, and I think like, okay, well, you know, whatever, what would happen if the restaurant became slower or, you know, how do you, you know, or if we, you know, if can we limit our dishes and maybe do something a little bit better or do something differently? Like, you know, I'm always looking at it.
Yeah.
But I think what we do now kind of fits like the stations, the way that they're set up, the kitchen flow, and it gives people a choice. But we're, you know, sometimes we'll get really excited, especially when the season changes, and we'll add and we'll add and we'll add, and I'll be like, okay, we need to like remove something because there's too many dishes on this menu.
Wow. So I want to, this idea you just mentioned, someone, I hope he's not going to be mad at me. I was being interviewed by someone the other day here in town, and they said to me that they had talked to some chefs recently who had started using this phrase, LA cuisine or LA food. Do you guys talk about this locally?
Not at all. You've never
talked about this with other chefs?
No.
But you kind of have this in your head as a thing.
Yeah, I mean,
you feel like it's a thing.
Yeah, I mean, LA food is just, I mean, we celebrate different ethnicities. I mean, you'll go to Walter's restaurant at Republic, and I think they have a pupusa on the menu.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't think it's really a pupusa. Like, I don't think if you ask a Mexican or a Salvadorian person, you know, is this a pupusa, that they would say, yes, it's a pupusa. But, you know, we're always trying to, like, pull from the different influences around us, which is kind of cool. But, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think it's typical of just LA. I think there's a lot of, you know, a lot of people that are doing that sort of thing, too.
Yeah, but it is interesting. I mean, I don't know. Historically, I look, you know, there was this phrase, California cuisine.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still around, still hanging around. But and then there was this phrase, New American cuisine, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what's the difference between the two, really?
Between California and New American?
Yeah.
Not much.
You know, and years ago, Mimi Sheridan, the former New York Times critic, wrote a piece for Time Magazine. It's like 33 years ago. It was called Eat American, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she tries to she basically, in a very small aside, said, basically said they were the same thing. mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And I always thought that was interesting. But I think a lot of, even then, what people were really talking about was what was happening in L.A.
Yeah.
I think it was what Wolfgang was doing. I think it was what somebody like Mary Sue and Susan were doing. Mm-hmm. I think it was Bruce Martyr, you know, who I'm helping to making a mission of popularizing. But I think it was very much what those people were doing. The late Michael Roberts, who people mm-hmm. don't remember, who had a restaurant called Trump's, mm-hmm. no relation to the president. But it was this eclectic international influence. That largely started here.
Yeah, I mean, L.A. is a place where people will travel to.
Yeah.
L.A. is a place where people want to move to.
Yeah.
Because of just, I mean, the weather, like, it's just a beautiful city.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's the diversity of people that we have here is just, it's incredible. And I think that, you know, Wolfgang is, you know, one of the big people that helped start that. And the produce that we get around here sort of defines that.
Yeah.
The products that we get, the proximity that we are to the East Coast and the fish that they have here, the fish that we have here, our access to Japanese ingredients and stuff like that overseas, it really helps define what America is, how our proximity to Mexico. Yeah. I mean, there's, like, you can get some of the best Mexican, you can get better Mexican food here than in Mexico in some places, you know?
Yeah.
It's really, really good.
It's amazing. So what about the community here? The chef community here, the industry here, what's it like? How would you describe it? Is it tight?
It is. You know, it is.
I mean, it's a spread out place, so it's different from a lot of other big cities.
I think everybody sort of respects everybody, and I think that that's great. But yeah, I don't go and visit Josiah Malise. I might see him at the farmer's market from time to time, but I'm not, and you know, he's very far away, and OTM is very far away. He'll come in, I'll go to his restaurants as well, but the proximity is difficult to get there. And if you if you're going to go and you're going to drink, it's a long Uber ride, you know?
It is. People who haven't spent time here, Los Angeles is just one of the cities around here.
Yeah.
You know, what most people think of as Los Angeles is a collection of municipalities, right? I mean, Santa Monica is a city.
Yeah, 100%.
Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
L.A., West Hollywood. These are municipalities unto themselves.
Yeah, if I want to go to the farmer's market in Santa Monica, it takes me an hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah, if you're lucky.
Yeah, and that's a long drive. That's that's a big, huge cut out of your day.
Right.
I think that people are very supportive of each other.
That's something you feel here is a very sort of distinctly, you feel that is one of the qualities of the industry here.
Yeah. And I think it's because people define themselves differently, you know, like,
what do you mean?
I mean, you know, Walter at Republic, like, what's he cooking? He's cooking, you know, his food is based on like French food but you know, he can do whatever influence he wants.
Right.
It's not taking away from what I'm doing at OTM. You know, I'm not trying to compete with what he's doing there.
It's so funny you say that because I'm a proud New Yorker. I've thought about moving here over the years. I think about spending some. I don't think I'll ever fully live anywhere else, but at the moment, with all due respect and affection to all these friends of mine back home, and I'm not talking about everybody, there is a bit of a sameness around the food.
Mm-hmm.
I personally believe it's because it's become so financially risky to open in New York that people hedge their bets. This is why we have all the jokes about the kale salad and the avocado toast and the chicken. You know, there are these things that kind of are ubiquitous in New York. You see them everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
This city does not. I mean, yes, there are certain things that you'll see, or there's we popular
have, we
ingredients.
We have plenty of kale salads and avocado toast.
Yes, you do. I think
probably started here.
I think the kale salad maybe is Brooklyn, but
really,
I don't know. I trace it back to Battersby.
Nice.
I do.
Yeah.
I mean, it was.
I don't know.
But I mean, in terms of like it, you know, taking off into the stratosphere.
Yeah.
But. But I do feel like, by and large, out here, it is so much more varied.
Yeah, it is.
And it's exciting.
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. I mean, and I think it's because people are able to take chances still.
Is that, do you connect it to what I just, I mean, do you think it's, I mean, it's not cheap to do restaurants here, but it just seems like you're less betting the farm when you do something here.
Yeah, I mean, depending on the different projects, yes, you definitely are. And I think, take a place like San Francisco, right? Like there's a lot of people that I've seen kind of travel around and the working sort of structure of what San Francisco is. And some of, like, you talk to like a chef de cuisine at maybe one restaurant, that guy was literally the chef de cuisine of three other restaurants in San Francisco that are all very popular.
Right.
You're like, okay, well, if that guy was coming up with the food there and then here and then here and then here,
right?
You know, there's it's very incestuous. You know, people mm-hmm. are going to take the same techniques and recipes,
yeah.
yes, apply them a little bit differently and stuff
yes,
like that. But
right.
you know, you're not going to have the crazy diversity that you have here,
right?
And I think that's what makes LA special. And you know, I don't know. It's a very unique city. Yeah. It really is.
Do you earlier I said I feel like you've really become a Los Angelino.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you're home for good? Like you feel like this is it for life?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in the process of buying a house. I'm thinking
right.
about where my kids are going to go to school. I mean, Odeum is, you know, hopefully a restaurant that, you know, it will last for a very long time. It'll
yeah.
be like kind of my, you know, my French Laundry, so to speak,
yeah.
my Spago, if you will.
Your legacy restaurant.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's what I hope and that's what I want it to be.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, this is a great place. I mean, I think, you know, there's tough things about LA. I mean, the real estate is crazy.
Yeah.
You know, the ability to be able to buy a house here is very, very difficult. The
right.
ability to be able to get around the city is extremely difficult,
yeah.
too. We don't have, like, a subway or a metro system that's, like, you know, as proficient as
yes.
New York. But,
yeah.
you know, LA is a beautiful place. And, you know, I think I'll probably live here for, you know, the remainder of my professional career.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's so great. You seem great.
Yeah.
I mean, you do. You seem very
happy. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it was great to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Thanks for letting me come to your home on a
Absolutely.
Saturday. And let's go, I don't know, let's go do something outside.
Let's do it.
And that's our show. Thank you, Tim Hollingsworth, for making the time, for letting me come to your home, for letting me see your wife, for letting me play with your kids. It was awesome. The whole thing was great. You know, I didn't say about Tim, you could tell in the interview, Tim loves family. Family is so important to him. His family, his siblings, his parents, like the whole thing. And now having his own family, it is something he's always wanted. I heard it firsthand. I can't believe I'm saying this. 10 years ago when I first met him in the context of writing that book, it's just a really important thing to him. And I just couldn't be happier for him. Tim, thanks for inviting me into all of it and for spending time with us. Caitlin, thank you.
My pleasure, Andrew. Always good to be here with you.
Thank you. And well, you live here.
Well, that's true, but I do still enjoy being here with you.
Thank you. David Tatasciore, our engineer, thank you for splicing this thing together. And thank all of you for listening. There will be, as fast as I can crank them out and as fast as David can get them on the air, shows with a bit more frequency than usual as I try to catch up and share this backlog of interviews that we have and get back to doing this once a week. But in the meantime, I hope you enjoy the extra shows. If you listen to them at the gym or as more and more people tell me during prep time in your restaurants or in the car or whatever it is on your commute, I hope you enjoy the extra episodes. There's some great people coming up and some really wonderful conversations. And that is it. Thanks for listening. See you back soon.